Okay, and welcome back to the Salty Journals podcast. We're actually in the middle of getting recordings down for series two. So please, if you do know anyone who you think would be suitable for the show, then get in touch, info@saltyjournals.com. But for now, if you're like many, if you're lucky enough to be heading away for the Easter long weekend, or if indeed you're stuck in around the house and getting some jobs done, then I thought we'd give you something to listen to. That something is a two-part episode on the Batavia wreck from the Gentleman at the Last Stop to Nowhere podcast, which is a podcast about the Australian history you never learnt at school. So if you're in the mood for a bit of a binge on Australian history, then I highly recommend you going over to the Last Stop to Nowhere podcast. The link will be in the show notes. Otherwise, stick around, listen to part one of The Wreck of the Batavia, with part two going live this coming Monday. Enjoy. The track underneath is by an excellent Perth band called Coastal Tang, with their track Sunset City. Again, links to that are in the socials. Enjoy the rest of the track and enjoy the rest of the show. Life was okay. Don't look back. I can't say the way you're great. No guarantee. Stay up. Off from the skies or from the heights. It's mad and mad. Oh, will I stay or choose to play? What's your story?
Hi, I'm Kyle.
And I'm Michael.
Welcome to Last Stop to Nowhere, our podcast about Australian history. Now, about 80 kilometres off the shore of Geraldton in Western Australia, there's this tiny lump of ossified barren rock and coral, which barely qualifies as an island. It's about 500 metres long. But at about 1628, there are about 100 people on this island, survivors of this shipwreck, castaways, and while most of them are just scrabbling out, trying to protect themselves from the elements, there's this one guy in particular who's recreated the grandest cabin in the ship, which wasn't his on the voyage, but he's put the carpets in, the artwork. He's sort of created around himself as his own personal little palace, some of the furniture even. And one night, when he's just sitting on this dead island in the middle of nowhere, he hears that, incredibly, one of the survivors has got this baby who's alive. So he calls in this clerk and he says, Deschamps, which was the guy's name, there is a half-dead child. You are not a fighting man. Here is a little noose. Go over there and fix it so that we here on the island do not hear so much wailing. After that, the clerk strangles the baby to death and murders him, and that was only one of the casualties that took place on this incredibly small piece of rock.
Can I just interject there? Sorry, we're opening with a dead baby.
This episode, we open with the dead baby.
That's a bold move. So, dare I ask the baby, why are we killing babies on desert islands?
Baby made the wrong enemy. That baby crossed one Geronimus Cornelizoon, who is this Dutch apothecary, kind of a Dutch version of a chemist. And today, we're going to talk about him, how he ended up on that island, how he forced these people on this island to do these atrocious deeds, and how it led to Australia's first known white inhabitants and our first European structures, which were a gallows.
Right, so 400 years ago, there was a Dutch chemist on an island who made himself a king and killed a baby and a bunch of other people?
Indirectly. He coerced others to do it for him.
All right, so who is this guy exactly?
So this guy, he's called Geronimus Cornelizoon. And for most of his life, he seems to be sort of an ordinary kind of upper middle class Dutch guy. He started off life, he was born in 1598. In Frisia, which was sort of in the North Netherlands. And he was born sort of upper class into a nice family, nice enough so that he got sent to proper school, had proper education at a Latin school, would have learnt some languages, learnt how to read and write, and eventually learned the trade of the apothecary. Now, what an apothecary is, it's kind of like a chemist in that they were in charge of preparing and distributing all medicines, all ointments and balms. They'd have their shop in the center of town. They'd give you all of the rhino horn, things like that. You know, they'd develop your photos. It was sort of a fixture of the community. So he set himself up originally in his hometown as an apothecary, but he soon got into this undisclosed argument with the town that led him to leave for the bigger city of Harlem. And this is typical of Geronimus. He seems to have this sort of dark cloud over him where he's always kind of surrounded by ignominy. He's always sort of getting into trouble with authority, but we never quite know why. He's a bit of a cipher. But he goes to Harlem and he sets up shop there in the bigger city. And things seem to be going pretty well for him until the year 1627, where everything hits a bit of a bump. So he's about sort of 30 years old. He's got a wife. He's well established. But his wife becomes pregnant. And as a midwife, he hires this lady who slept with an axe, for one thing. She also compulsively sung and danced everywhere and admitted to torments inside the head. I know, presumably during a job interview or something. And
so
she's
not exactly a good judge of character then. Wait, so this is the midwife who's going to deliver his baby.
Yeah, his unborn son. Okay. So she sleeps with an axe, which I know shows willingness and preparedness, if not anything
she
else.
She thinks ahead.
Yeah.
Did the midwife do a good job?
She botched it, sadly. And this part is quite sad because his wife, we don't know much about. The midwife accidentally, during the delivery of the birth, leaves a fragment of placenta inside the womb, which leads to an infection, which makes his wife basically bedridden and sort of fever-ridden during the critical first few months of the baby's life.
Right, so sorry, is it a midwife behind or just a schizophrenic homeless woman? Like, what is he actually...
Column A, but this leads to his second hire, which is a wet nurse. So he hops back on Craigslist. He's like, the last one worked out well. Now I need someone to provide milk to my baby because my wife can't. For the wet nurse, he goes for another sort of outside hire. He recruits this lady who was well known for her public screaming matches and was apparently so ridden with syphilis that her hair was falling out of her scalp in clumps. So
it's like the A-team. He's got the midwife with the axe, and he's got the syphilitic wet nurse.
Yeah, and unfortunately, well, like the A-team, everything wrapped up in about 20 minutes.
So this is our second dead baby, may I point out. Okay, so dead baby number two. And does he? What happens to him next?
This is sort of the beginning of the end of his picture-perfect Harlem lifestyle. His family is in tatters, and during the court case, because after his baby dies of syphilis, his practice is in a bit of hot water because no one really wants to buy rhino horn from a guy whose baby just died from a very afflicting, very contagious illness. So he has to sue the wet nurse in a long, drawn-out court case, basically to publicly establish that he himself and his wife were sort of unbesmirched by the illness. This sort of drags their whole family life into the gutter. So it's looking like it's a good time to maybe leave town. This is combined with yet another thing that's going wrong with his life at the moment, which is that...
Who did he hire this time?
No, this is actually his own management. His business is actually going down the gurgler a bit. He's losing money a lot. He's taken on a lot of loans that he can't pay back. And he's just recently, to avoid bankruptcy, had to pledge everything he owned to his creditor.
Right, so Geronimus, at this stage, this is 1627. He's a bankrupt former chemist with a dead baby, and he's a poor judge of character. How does he end up in Australia, or off the coast of Australia on this desert island?
Well, when you've lost this much and you want to get it back, there's pretty much one way you could turn in 17th century Dutch land. And so in the Netherlands, there's one way you can turn, and that's the Dutch East India Company, which was a massive company that was always guaranteed to welcome you with open arms.
Yes, but Dutch East India Company, they will take absolutely anybody. So Geronimus is bankrupt, his business is in ruins, his kid is dead. I think his wife is dead as well, is that?
No, his wife's still alive.
Wife's still alive, all right. His wife's still alive, but everyone in the town that he's practicing thinks he gave the baby syphilis. He is a horrible judge of character. He's embroiled in all his legal cases with the midwife and the wet nurse and whatnot. And the only place that he can think of to revive his flagging fortunes is, as Carl mentioned, the Dutch East India Company. Now, it had a number of names. One of those was the Jan Company, which is Dutch for John. It's called the John Company because it had its tentacles in every single arm of the Dutch economy. The Dutch initials are VOC, and we'll call it that just to save time. It's founded in 1602. It's the world's probably largest multinational corporation, I'll go so far as to say, in history. To give you an idea of how large it was, a single share of the company at its height, at the company's peak, a single share would cost you today $64,000.
They had shares back then?
They did, yeah. The VOC, it's interesting because it was founded as a joint stock company. So Dutch merchants would invest in these voyages to the east to bring back spice and sort of pearls, silver, copper, textiles, all this good stuff from China, Japan, and the spice islands around Indonesia. Because it was so expensive and so hazardous to underwrite one of these voyages, the merchants started banding together, and the result was the Dutch East India Company. Now, the motto was, God is good, but gold is better. So it was very, very financially focused. I think it was also had its own army, too. So it had about, at its height, about 50,000 employees, as well as a private army of 10,000 soldiers. And each year, if you were one of the lucky investors, you could expect to see about a 40% return on your investment. So for every $64,000 share that you bought, each year you get 40% of that value back as a bonus based on the success of the voyages that they were sending out. So enlisting in the VOC, it was a pretty hazardous proposition. We have a quote here which says, "Even a man who has beaten his own mother and father to death is too good to go to the East Indies." Now, that was due to a couple of things, largely because the life expectancy, if you did enlist, was fairly low. They estimated any merchant who enlisted with the company and went over to Indonesia to trade spice had about a three-year life expectancy due to tropical diseases and also the conditions that they were living in during the voyage. And about 1 in 10 people, soldiers and sailors, would die on the voyages over there. The VOC was also described as a great refuge for spoiled brats, bankrupts, cashiers, brokers, tenants, bailiffs, and informers. Generally, it's not a great place to work, I don't think.
It's a last resort.
Yeah.
It's when your back's against the wall and there's nothing left for you in your home port, you roll the dice and you enlist with the VOC on the off chance that you get to survive long enough to make a bit of cash on the side.
So even though there's all this wealth flooding into the company, all the shareholders are making a lot of money, the actual employees were not seeing a lot of it.
We should also say the reason why there was so much money to be found in these expeditions that were taken to the East Indies is because these spices they're bringing back aren't sort of used in the way we think of spices now to sort of spruce up a dish on My Kitchen Rules or whatever. These were basically spices to make rotting meat palatable, to disguise the stench and the taste of rancid food. The food preservation was so poor back in the 17th century that even the highborn would be eating just this rotten flesh. So spice became immensely important to the middle and upper class just so they could basically stomach what they were eating.
And also the only place to get these spices what was in the East, and the overland route was blocked by the Ottoman Empire. So the alternative was to do these long voyages around the world of between 8 to 10 months, and they would take anybody. Anybody they were always in need of, due to the attrition rate, the death toll for company employees. They had an open door policy to new hires. We've also got a little interesting nugget is the Dutch Navy had a policy of never ever hiring anybody, any seaman who'd ever worked for the VOC. They were considered the lowest of the low. It was a place that you went to when you had no other options at all. And that's where Geronimus found himself in 1628.
So Geronimus signs up with the Dutch East India Company, and the ship that he's signed up to join is called the Batavia. It is the flagship of the Dutch East India Company. It's just been newly minted, and it's probably the most sophisticated piece of machinery they've ever built.
The ship itself, they estimate its net worth in today's money is about $200 to $300 million. As Carl said, an extremely complex piece of machinery. From the bottom of the ship to the mast, it was about 18 to 19 stories tall. It's about 186 feet high. It was sailing to the East Indies as part of a fleet. As Carl mentioned, it was the flagship of this fleet. It also carried a large amount of money on board, so about $25 million in cash in today's money, or 250,000 guilders. Now, on board, there's about 341 passengers. as a large contingent of soldiers, about 100, and also some sailors who had to be kept separate on the voyage because fights would often break out. And the soldiers were basically mercenaries. And again, the Dutch East India Company was not a picky employer, so they would just take whoever walked in the door. So sort of conditions on board were very tense, and passengers were kept segmented from the crew, and the soldiers kept away from the sailors, and it was very upstairs, downstairs vibe on the ship.
So who's running the ship?
Running the ship, so it's a guy called Francisco Pelsart. He's the upper merchant, and he's in charge of this fleet.
Not the captain?
No, not the captain. You think the captain would be in charge, but in the Dutch East India Company, the captain is kind of treated like a truck driver. His job is to get them over there, and the merchant is the one who's in charge of everything.
A truck driver minus the more whimsical sort of aspects of trucker culture, like the cool hats, the truck stops. It's basically just getting it from A to B with no romanticism.
Yeah. Whereas, I mean, Francisco Pelsart, his position is more like a store manager. So he's in charge of everything that's on there, and the captain or the skipper, he just has to get them from A to B. Now, Francisco Pelsart is interesting. He's like Geronimus in the sense he's a bit of an outsider. Basically joined the company due to lack of other options, and he sailed to India in 1618. So Pelsart has spent a lot of his career with the company over in the East, and he's posted to... A lot of his career was spent in the Mughal court in India, where Pelsart was sent as a kind of ambassador to sort of wow the Mughal court with the wealth and the brilliance of the company. So he was there as a trader to make a profit, but also he was a diplomatic representative of the company.
The Mughal court is also where we get the modern day term mogul, meaning a very, very rich sort of baron. So when he was sent over to impress these guys, this was an empire that the European powers were already very impressed with and definitely wanted a piece of, so it was a bit of a prestigious posting.
Yeah, absolutely, and there's a lot of peacocking going on where everyone was whispering in the ears of the Mughal Empire saying, because their only knowledge of conditions back in Europe came from these merchants and diplomats posted over there. So the Dutch would say, actually, we're the strongest power in Europe, we're the biggest, and the English would say, actually, no, nobody likes the Dutch, and you know, there were Germans, there were French, there were Spanish, so it was this very kind of very soap opera-esque atmosphere at the court. Now, Pelsart makes a bit of a splash. There's a few notorious incidents he's involved in while he's over there. We'll just mention this to give you an idea of what kind of a man he was. Probably the most notorious is Pelsart was a big womanizer. He had affairs with several women at the Mughal court, including the wife of a court official who one night they were having a liaison at the Dutch trading headquarters, and while Pelsart was in another room, she came across a bottle of what she thought was wine, but turned out to be the equivalent of brake fluid, and she drank it and died. And Pelsart sort of found himself with a dead princess on his hand.
How did he get out of that one?
He buried it in the garden of they called it the Dutch factory. It was their trading base in Surat in India. So he, in the middle of the night, along with some other merchants, dug a hole and put her in the hole, and that was the end of that.
Hastily scribbled a note in her handwriting saying she was like...
going to go see some relatives in the countryside for a while.
Yeah, off to try a career in show business.
Yeah, so he had a bit of a murky past. Another thing is he was quite poorly paid by the standards of the time. So to sort of keep himself in a style to which he'd become accustomed, he ran a loan sharking business on the side using company money and lending it out. And to avoid getting caught, when his successor came, he told him how to do it and kept it going so he wouldn't implicate him. We should mention this as well. He's a bit of an outsider. He's Catholic. Actually, this is the one area where they actually do have some rules. They don't hire Catholics. They're Protestant only, and Pelsart keeps that a bit of a secret. As well, we should mention in India, he has a serious tropical illness he contracts that reoccurs during the voyage. So he spends a lot of his time in the bathroom or in his cabin. Now, when he returns to the Netherlands, he's expecting quite a big promotion. So he comes back. He's spent 8 years in the Mughal court. He speaks the language, which is quite unusual, and he has this idea for how the company can increase its power at the Mughal court. It's sort of his policy is basically toys. The company should invest in
toys.
Actual toys, actual like little silver kind of knickknacks and ornaments and amulets. And pretty much the idea is over in the Mughal Empire, the only people with any kind of disposable money are the court officials, are the lords and the aristocracy, who they already have peasants, they already have food and sort of all the basic things they need. The one thing they don't have are kind of curiosities and antiques from the other side of the world. So Pelsart, he comes back and his sort of plan, which he puts to the company, and the company's board of directors, it's a group called the 17 Gentlemen. So it's sort of like a modern board of directors. So he presents to them and says, look, let's hire some artisans and some artists. Let's whip up a bunch of kind of, they called them Nurembergers. They're pretty much shiny knickknacks, baubles. And we'll load the ship up with them. We'll bring them back. We'll sell them. We'll make a great profit. And also we'll display the craftsmanship of the Dutch to the Moguls and increase our position at the court. Now, to give you an idea of what Pelsaert was like to deal with, we've got a quote here from a rival merchant, one of his enemies. He says that Pelsaert was considered to lie with every third word he said, and his mouth was rarely quiet. So he's sort of got a very, he's got a very murky reputation. Bit of a
Pelsaert,
mixed character.
You think of his background and you think, oh, this guy's a bit of a bad boy. But he was actually quite a sensitive guy. You can see reading his journals of the ship and the fact that he learns the languages of all these lands he visits. He displays a genuine curiosity and humanity towards all of the different lands and peoples he encounters, which was very rare for these sort of mercenary merchants that the Dutch East India Company was sending out. And, he does like to sort of flirt a bit with the women, which can end disastrously, but...
Yeah, he killed a princess. Come on. I mean, yeah, sure. He's good at learning languages, and I'm sure he's a nice guy, but we've just gone through all this stuff where, you know, he's a liar, he runs a loan sharking operation, he killed a princess, his kind of big idea is selling toys. Is it somebody that do you like him?
Well, he's a very hard character to gauge, but I do think that his humanity in his journals does come through. He's a bit of a sensitive guy, a bit of a sensey, and he's not very used to sea, and he's not really sort of one of the crew in that sense.
He's not one of the boys. He's described as small and kind of appeared like a bit of a pixie. Now, he is in charge of this voyage, as you mentioned, but the actual, Kyle raised this before, he's not the guy who's going to be steering the ship, he's going to be getting them there. He's in charge of the overall fleet, but Kyle, can you tell us a little bit about, on the Batavia, where Cornelia's enlists on, who's the guy who's actually steering this thing?
Now, the head of the sort of the sailor side of things, the captain of the ship, but not the boss of the actual mission.
So the truck driver?
The trucker. Our trucker in charge is this guy called Arjen Jacobs, just to round out the crew. He's sort of in his 40s, and in his 40s, he's probably one of the oldest people on board. He's served the VOCs for 2 decades, so he's enjoyed sort of life employment with the VOC, but he's a careerist with them, but with them a career is just not dying. It's not sort of like rising up the ladder. They view him as very much a workaday, get the ship from one spot to another.
And he is good at that. He's a fantastic captain. He comes from a fishing family from way back, and the fact that he survived for so long shows that he's got a very, very strong constitution.
He does have a weakness, though. That's the booze. He's a bit of a booze hound, loves to drink. And when he drinks, he gets a little bit prickly. He gets a little bit sensitive of himself. He really doesn't like it when other people try and boss him around on his ship. He actually met Pelsaert beforehand. They took another voyage together where he hit the Jack Daniels, and then Pelsaert started trying to call the shots or maybe just looked at him funny, and he got in sort of a drunken argument with him. And Pelsaert was filing that away as, I do not trust this guy. But as a two-decade captain, he was probably one of the best stalwarts the VOC had. So when it came to appointing the crew for their flagship, the Batavia, he was the one that they put to drive it.
Yeah, the company didn't take egos into the equation. But basically, Pelsaert, who's in charge of the fleet, he hates the captain and the captain hates him. And Geronimus is he's the newbie on board. They sign him on as an undermerchant. Basically means it's kind of...
A bit of a bureaucrat. He can read and write, which would have been immensely valuable to the company. That would have automatically got him some kind of trading position. But basically, is there to help the big bureaucrat on board crunch the numbers when it comes to calculating all of their different trades.
So we've got a bankrupt chemist who's a horrible judge of character. We've got this corrupt merchant, and we've got the alcoholic buffoonish captain. Now, they set sail, and Kyle, can you tell us a little bit? So they're heading to Indonesia. What's the voyage going to be like?
The voyage is, even for the hoi polloi of the ship, it's just hellish. There is only so much you can do to make a confined space such as the ship hospitable to human life at all. And in the 17th century, they weren't that great at it. The VOC had got down to a fine art form, the idea of getting a ship in one piece from point A to point B with about just enough of the crew alive to take it back so that they could, you know, refuel with people on the other end. So they knew that casualties were expected, and they didn't really care as long as attrition wasn't sort of paralyzing. The hygiene was awful. During storms, when they had to block up the sort of bilge holes, the people on the lower decks, the soldiers and the plebs, some of the sailors, they were basically awash in human waste, which they couldn't get rid of. The toilets were just sort of off the side of the ship if you could. If you couldn't, if it was too stormy, just down the hole into the sailor or soldier's quarters.
Also, we should point out the toilet paper that you used was actually a piece of rope that was lowered. So the toilets are basically an open hole. You'd sit on, you'd do your business, and then when you wanted to clean yourself up, you had to pull a piece of rope up from the ocean below and wipe yourself with it and then throw it back for the next person. So not terribly hygienic.
The water was safe for drinking, so they used, most of the sailors and soldiers used their own urine to wash their clothes. And whenever they did stop at port, even though the Batavia was a brand new ship, as soon as it stopped at port, it was just filled with vermin and insects instantly. There's this one story of one Dutch East India Company commander who gets sick of the insects crawling everywhere, so he decides to put a bounty of a shot of spirits for it every 1,000 dead roaches he gets given. And within a few days, he's been given 38,000 roach corpses. So it's like that with roaches, with rats, lice, bed bugs, everything. The food is full of maggots, full of bugs. You could apparently tell a sailor at home because they'd always tap their bread against the wall, basically to dislodge all the maggots or as many as possible. The meat they ate was rotting, much like the meat in Amsterdam. It was just a hive of illness and disease and bad hygiene.
So it's not a luxury cruise, basically.
Yeah.
And the important thing, though, is the common sort of soldiers and sailors, they have their quarters in the ship, but Geronimus, who's our chemist, who's come on board, and Pelsart, the commander, and the skipper, Jacobs, they have quarters on the slightly better quarters. They have a great cabin, which they can go into for meetings and dinner parties.
They have their own little bathroom to share.
They do have their own little bathroom, which becomes important.
There's not much to do on the ship. When you get tired of just sort of eating maggoty food, there's not that much in the way of distraction from the horrible circumstances you're in. So anything at all that you can use to take your mind off things you do. And luckily for the upper class, who weren't so much interested in gambling and knife fighting like the sailors were, there was one particularly luring distraction on board the Batavia. And that was this woman called Lucretia Yarns, who was a high-born woman, unescorted, except for a chambermaid she brought with her called Devanti. And she was going to the East Indies to be with her husband, who was employed by the VOC over there. So already it's very rare to have women on board, and it's definitely very rare to have high-born, beautiful women on board. So she becomes sort of like this object of adoration for a lot of the crew. Yeah. And a couple of members in particular become especially infatuated with her. The upper merchant Pelsart gets a bit of a crush.
Basically, it turns into Days of Our Lives. So everyone is trying, saying, oh, unattached pretty woman, 8-month cruise, let's see what we can do. Pelsart is the first one to approach Lucretia. He sort of takes a very subtle approach. He's wining and dining her. They're spending a lot of one-on-one time in the great cabin, talking about books and art.
Playing charades,
that kind of thing. So he's sort of taking a very, very gentle, subtle tact, whereas Jacob's the captain, on the other hand, he's got a more direct approach.
Yeah, he's like, you know, Pelsart's doing his little let's be friends spiel, but I know the way to a woman's heart, and that's hassling her until she says yes, and if that doesn't work, trying to pay money to her, and if that doesn't work, then just going for a chambermaid, because she looks up for it. Which finally did work, so he got in there. Basically, Jacobs, the captain, incessantly hits on Lucretia to the point where it becomes very awkward on board. He tries to romance her, but it's not so much like the Love Boat, like you'd imagine. It's really just sort of awkward, uncomfortable, like, I don't know, watching an episode of The Love Boat. But
well, one example of how uncomfortable it is, so Pelsart, we mentioned before, he's got this mysterious tropical illness that he's contracted in India. It flares up on the voyage. So for a lot of it, when he's not trying to romance Lucretia, things are coming out of his mouth and out of his other end in the one bathroom that all the officers share. One night when he has a particularly vicious attack of this illness, he runs in there to use it, walks in on the captain and Swanji, the chambermaid, I guess sort of mid-intercourse. Mid-coitus in the bathroom, and he's sort of standing there really, really needing to go. So it's just not a happy boat.
Things get a bit heated between the captain and the merchant after that. He finds the captain getting more and more into a loose cannon. The captain's starting to actually flaunt his relationship with this chambermaid, which is quite unusual.
Poor taste.
Yeah, because I mean, while the captain, people of that rank could get away with the odd indiscretion, you don't sort of parade it around and throw it in the lady's face, which he was starting to do.
So basically, the boat has left the Netherlands on the 27th of October, 1628. The next year, on the 14th of April, so we're not even mid-voyage yet, they make it to Africa on the 14th of April. They have a stopover on the Cape of Africa. They take on supplies, and Pelsart goes ashore to sort of haggle with the merchants and arrange for fresh water and supplies to be taken on the ship. Now, while he does that, the captain, Jacobs, and Zwanji, the chambermaid, they go on a sort of a cruise together.
They go on a bender with Geronimus. So they get in the little yacht that they use to travel between boats of the ship. They get drunk and disorderly, and they run up to the neighboring ship in the fleet. Jacobs gets in a fight with it. Geronimus is sort of egging him on the side, and he just makes a complete fool of himself, so that when Pelsart finally gets back, still feeling under the weather, still feeling pretty sick, having just secured fresh supplies, is inundated with complaints from other captains.
So Jacobs gets kicked off every other ship in the fleet, just about. So he gets banned, and sort of Pelsart gives him a good behavior warning. Jacobs doesn't take that very kindly.
This dressing down that Pelsart gives him, it should be underscored, because Pelsart has to officially reprimand him for his behavior. And he does so quite publicly so that he doesn't lose face. And he sort of chastises the captain and emasculates him in a way, which the captain, already being a very prickly man who doesn't like other people telling him what to do, this emasculation and his growing boldness with Zvanchi, this is really the last straw where he starts thinking up these sort of dangerous ideas.
So we have a quote here, and it's there's a conversation between Cornelius and Jacobs. So after Jacobs gets told off, after he gets his dressing down, he's standing out on the deck of the ship, and Cornelius comes up just to sort of see how it went. And Jacob says to Cornelius, he says, "By God, if those ships weren't lying out there," so it means the other ships in the fleet, "if those ships weren't lying out there, then I would treat that miserly dog," referring to Pelsart, "I would treat that miserly dog so that he could not come out of his cabin for 14 days. And were I a bit younger, then as soon as we lifted our anchor, I would do something else." So he's basically saying, if there wasn't other ships around, I would just beat up Pelsart. And then if I was a younger man, I'd do something else. And Geronimus says, "Well, what would that be if you were younger? What would you do?" Jacobs replies, he says, "I would very quickly make myself master of the ship."
Jacobs and Geronimus are starting to talk mutiny.
Yeah, so basically the ship it's halfway through its journey. There's personal rivalries and sexual jealousies swirling around. And Pelsart is spending most of his time in his cabin sick. Jacobs is nursing this grudge based on what Pelsart's done to him in India, the dressing down he's just given him during their port stop off. And Cornelius is sort of the man in the middle watching this all. Now, he gets on quite well with both of them. He's sort of a very convivial presence on board. Everyone seems to like him. So in the great cabin where they have dinners together, Cornelius sort of, he amuses the guests by talking about, they sort of have religious debates, hypotheticals, sort of, they play traveler's games to pass the time. He's a very engaging guest.
He amuses them because he's a great conversationalist, but some of the things he's saying are really quite naughty. Like, there's a predicant on board. A predicant is a Dutch kind of minister, preacher. And he starts baiting this predicant, floating these sort of what-ifs about there being no God, no heaven.
Two things about the priest. The priest finds it delightful. The priest loves it. Geronimus is dead serious about all these things, by the way. But the priest finds him, just a great company at dinner. And also the priest, just to continue with our theme of this is everybody's last chance, the priest is also a former bankrupt. He has 8 children, and the only way to feed those 8 children is going on a kamikaze mission to Indonesia and hoping to find a parish somewhere that will have him, where he can preach and where he can support his massive family.
So the Batavia's had its pit stop in Africa, which was disastrous, and now it's heading on the home stretch of its voyage to Batavia, which takes it right across the middle of the ocean and up to a stage where they basically have to guesstimate when they're below Indonesia so they can turn back up. So it's by far the sort of most tenuous part of the journey. It's when you need your captain at its peak. And it's where things can sort of go deeply, deeply wrong if you start getting lost or becalmed, if the winds stop blowing. So this is when Geronimus starts his campaign of whispering into the ear of Jacobs, the captain. And I think there's a quote from Pelsart's journal that Michael has that sort of describes the role he took in this.
So basically, where we are now, it's Jacobs really doesn't like Pelsart, the upper merchant, and Pelsart really doesn't like him. And Cornelius is sort of, is on the sidelines, is getting on well with both. But his actions start to be a bit more sinister. So Pelsart writes in his journal, Geronimus, having made himself a great friend and highly familiar with the skipper, Jacobs, moulded their similar intelligence and feelings into one, the skipper being innate with prideful conceit and ambition, so that he could not endure the authority of any over him. Moreover, he was mocking and contemptuous of all people. And it goes on and goes on. Basically, he has about 400 words where he's like, I really don't like this captain. And he says, on the contrary, though, Geronimus was well-spoken and usually knew how to give the polish of truth to his lying words. He was far more sly and skilled in getting on with people. Geronimus was the tongue of the skipper and served as a teacher to insinuate into him what he should answer if I wanted to speak or to admonish him. He's basically Lady Macbethingham. He's sort of like, yeah, you know, you should be really the one running this. But why is he doing this, though? What is he actually after?
It's hard to gauge the motivation of Geronimus. He's such a cloudy individual. He seems like a smart guy. He would have had to have been a pretty smart guy. But he makes these strange decisions in his personal life. He always leaves in these clouds of dispute. He seems like a guy who just really enjoys
sort of
watching
a puppet master.
Yeah, watching people fall around him and manipulating others. And this is why he starts actually saying the M word, which is a really big deal, the idea of mutiny on the ship of the Dutch East India Company.
And one reason for mutiny is, we mentioned before, there's $25 million in cash on this ship. So about the actual amount at the time was 250,000 guilders worth of silver coins, as well as caskets of jewels and other valuable items of cargo. It amounts to $25 million in today's money, and the ship itself is worth quite a bit as well, and the supplies on there. So Cornelius sort of formulates this plan. This is all murky. We find this out from the trial afterwards, and Pelsart gradually realizes it and notes it down in his journal as he sees what's happening. Basically, Cornelius and the captain, they get a rough plan together where they're going to seize the ship, stage a mutiny, take the ship over to either the Caribbean or back up to Spain and sort of live as pirates, sell the goods on the ship and retire. And because it takes so long for news to travel back to the homeland, they've got about a 6-month head start before anybody realizes the ship has been hijacked. So they managed to seize control. They've got this virtual gold mine that they're sailing on. They can take it anywhere in the world. No one will be chasing them for 6 months, and they have the potential to all die rich.
At this point in Europe as well, if you're hated in one European country, there's a very good chance you could find sanctuary in another, just for that reason. The powers being at their throats for any small advantage. And the secrets of these long voyages and the sort of methods you use to get from point A to point B being these closely guarded corporate secrets, they just would have been able to sell their stories as well as the material wealth on the ship. And it's a very strange mutiny plan, because usually with mutiny and the mutinies that happened in the past on the Dutch East India Company vessels, they're usually sort of popular uprisings from the crew, the people who suffer the worst conditions on the ship. The idea of a captain and this under merchant sort of conspiring to take over the vessel must have been very, very scary to a person like Pelsart, because what happened with the other mutinies is that you usually were able to deal with the mutineers. What would happen is they would give a list of demands, they would sort of occupy the ship, and then the leader of the ship would say, okay, well, sort of back up on discipline a bit.
Double the rum ration. So it's more of a strike than a mutiny, I guess.
Yeah, it's sort of an industrial action. Whereas the sheer size of the cargo on the Batavia and the fact that you've got these two, well, there's one very disgruntled captain mixed with a very, very scheming, manipulative under merchant is a very dangerous combination.
Usually when there are mutinies or industrial actions, it's the captain and the upper merchant working together. They can dampen down the tension. But when you've got the captain fueling the tension, it's far more dangerous. When you've got someone so senior who knows how to steer the ship, knows how it works, that's a different prospect. So it's a capital M mutiny.
And around this time, Jacob starts using his position as the captain to start putting things into effect. And his first job in that is, I've got to separate this ship from the rest of the fleet, because we can't take over this ship if the other ships are still there around us. We won't be able to go off pirating. So he's very clever about it. Fleets do get separated quite regularly. So he just steers them a little bit away, sort of lags a bit, speeds a bit. The other ships in the fleet aren't nearly as good as the Batavia, so he's got that to his advantage, where they have to go slow. He can afford to go a little bit faster, a little bit further off course, until he's finally succeeded and they're absolutely alone in the ocean. Now, this is still at a point where they have to guess exactly when they're under Indonesia, otherwise they're all screwed. At this point in time, all they really know about Australia is this tiny fragment of our Western Australian coast. It's been theorized to exist since, like, the ancient Greeks, but we really didn't advance further than the idea of this massive counterweight continent that sort of had to be there.
So basically, the Dutch East India Company at the time, they'd scouted a tiny, tiny bit of the West Australian coast. They knew there was something there. It's just that there was no profit in, if there's such an investment to send one of these merchant fleets out, every second that they're not on the trade route and they're not trading and they're not selling and buying, that's lost money and that's lost opportunity. So they never really have the incentive to explore. So they've pretty much got a route worked out where ships sail from the Netherlands, as Carl mentioned. They go down to Africa, they get supplies. They actually go the opposite way. They sail towards Brazil and South America to catch these trade winds called the Roaring Forties, which are strong, consistent winds, which you, once you hit them, you turn the ship around and the winds push you all the way to sort of the coast of Western Australia, the little bit that they've got outlined on their rough maps. And then from there, you turn up and you go to Indonesia. So you bypass Australia altogether, but you know it's there. But pretty much if you see Australia, you've gone too far. Yeah. You want to turn before you get there. To measure how fast they were going, they had a stick and they were tied to a rope. They would throw the stick off the back of the boat. They had an hourglass. They would run the hourglass until all the sand inside had expired. So sort of a 30-second hourglass. They'd pull the stick back in and see how far the rope had unraveled. And that gave them a rough estimation of how many knots in the rope, how fast they were traveling.
So they're adrift in the sea at this point. Jacobs has got his old rope on the stick and is sort of tweedling the rope, tweedling the stick to get them a bit further away from the fleet. And then he's thinking, this is actually really great. I've got Zwanti by my side. She seems to be into me. I've got this ship that I'm sitting on filled with unimaginable wealth. And Pelsart is just sick, lying, dying in his bed. He's going to... They expected him to die imminently. So when Pelsart makes a miraculous recovery and appears, just pops up on board again, this really throws all of the mutineers off. It almost scuttles their plans completely.
Well, we should mention, so the mutiny starts out, and it's just Jacobs and Cornelius at first, just the two of them. Now, when they decide, wouldn't it be a great idea if we steal this ship and we retire rich, they start putting out feelers to other people on board. They break it down. So Jacobs, the captain, he approaches the first mate, the bosun, other sailors on the ship that he knows and has worked with and that trust him, and he starts recruiting them into his conspiracy, whereas Geronimus, he starts recruiting some of the company officials and some of the soldiers on board. So two of their first recruits is a guy called, he's a corporal in the mercenaries on board. His name is Peters. His nickname is Stonecutter because he was very, very physically large. He sort of had fists that could... if you hit a stone, it would break in half. Now, Stonecutter Peters, he recruits other soldiers, and Geronimus recruits some of the company clerks. But they've got a very small band of people. It's about 13 people signed up to this mutiny in all. So the plan is, originally, as Kyle said, hopefully Pelsart is really sick, will die this natural death. Then Geronimus and Jacobs, they're the next in the chain of command. They'll take over the ship. And with these 13 people, they recruit others, and gradually, I guess they'll sort of, they've got the authority to run the ship, and they'll take it to a welcoming foreign port and sell everything on board.
Basically, no one else would have stood a chance. They would have intimidated all the passengers. As for the soldiers on board, their plan with them was simply to nail the hatch shut when the soldiers were all in that one deck they had. So they were just going to leave them to stew.
They're just going to suffocate the soldiers to death. That was the original plan. But Pelsart recovers, which is sort of throws a kink in the works.
So with Pelsart up and out again, they know they need to think up some kind of strategy to work around this. And you can see Geronimus's fingerprints all over the strategy they end up choosing. Geronimus basically says, we need to have an incident occur which has to inspire Pelsart to really crack down. It has to be such a heinous incident that Pelsart overreacts and punishes everyone, and then we can use that groundswell of resentment to bring others to our cause. The incident they decide to choose, it's not a surprise if you sort of think of Cornelius's character, that they choose to attack Lucretia Yarns, the highborn woman on the ship.
So this is the woman that everybody's in love with, but no one. She's loyal to her husband who's serving over in the Dutch East Indies, and she's not reciprocating to anybody's romantic advances. So we should point out, Pelsart at this stage has no idea what's going on. Even though he's out and about, he's still pretty sick, and I think for him it's still just a relief to be able to go to the bathroom and not find the captain in there making out with his girlfriend. So this, what happens next comes as a huge surprise. One night, as Lucretia is walking back from dinner in the grand cabin with Pelsart, she's attacked by a group of men wearing masks and cloths over their face. They smear her with dung. They smear her face and her body with sort of a mixture of dung and mud and other black substances.
And tar
as well. And they cover her with it. And then they're completely silent. They gag her as well. So they cover her all over. They tar her without the feathering, I guess. They just cover her in horrible things. And then they basically vanish and leave her there. She's found and brought to Pelsart, and Pelsart is outraged. And so the idea is that because the attack was a group of people and because they were wearing disguises, Pelsart's investigation is going to have to be thorough, and there's a risk that he'll be accused of overreacting. So Jacobs is counting on Pelsart getting furious that this would happen on the ship and cracking down hard, and that cracking down fueling the mutiny that he's trying to start. So Pelsart, his reaction is he starts investigating, and quickly he works out something odd is going on. He doesn't know how many people were involved in the attack. There's nobody who's talking. And he sort of realizes that the mood on the ship has changed. And Pelsart, you sort of start to see in his diary entries here this growing awareness that something unusual is going on, something out of the ordinary. Now, Pelsart's policy towards the attack on Lucretia is keep everything together on the ship until we get to Indonesia, until there's other company officials around, we can launch a thorough investigation, rather than sort of trying to start his own investigation on board. So he doesn't do what Jacobs wants him to do. He doesn't crack down hard.
So it's in this state of heightened aggression and heightened divide between everyone on the brink of a mutiny where they crash into the Abrolhos Island.
This episode has been brought to you by the team at Money Over 50, the podcast and financial advisors. The team at Money Over 50 help those over 50, and anyone else who's interested in planning for retirement, to make sure their plans are sorted so that they can go in and focus on the things that they enjoy, such as spending time on, in, or under the water. I just finished listening to episode 111, which is called The Difference Between Gold, Property, and Companies. It was really interesting and super informative. I learned a lot that I didn't know before. Michael and Dallas and the rest of the team down there really do know their stuff. So as soon as you get a moment, head over to the show notes here, or go to Apple Podcasts or any of the podcast hosts of your choice. Type in Money Over 50 and have a listen.
Hootman's Abrolhos, in Portuguese it means, what does Abrolhos mean?
It's sort of a slang term meaning keep your eyes peeled.
And they don't. They crash right into it at night. And
it's the worst case scenario for a crash. They're going full speed when they hit. It's the night. Someone actually calls the skipper up, the guy who's keeping a watch out. He sees a glimmer in the distance. He's like, is this a reef? Jacob says, no, it's not. We're nowhere near anything. By this stage, I'm not sure if it was simply bad luck or if his little tweakings with the navigation caused it, but they were very far from where they thought they were. They were, in fact, right off Australia.
They've missed the turn. They're meant to turn to Indonesia, but they've gone too far, and they've now crashed. So what happens next when the boat is wrecked?
Immediately, they start trying to cut loose some of the dead weight on the ship. The brass cannons, the brand new ones, they go, they try and sort of take stock, take measure of exactly how badly they've been hit.
So it's a low-lying reef. The ship is beached on it. There's waves crashing against it. It's the middle of the night. And they're throwing the anchor out. They're throwing everything overboard that they can. But nothing is working. They can't get it loose.
What they find is that it's the worst-case scenario. They find through measuring the water that rather than hitting it at low tide, if it was low tide, then the rising water level might have lifted them off. They actually hit it pretty close to high tide. So if anything, with every hour that passes, they're just going to get more and more stranded. The weight of the ship underneath that massive main mast that Michael described earlier is just crushing it when it's out of the water. One of the descriptions we've read calls it a pile driver that's slowly just screwing the ship down further and further. Even the angle of the coral they hit is sort of keeping them trapped.
Nothing is good about this situation. It's like the worst of all possible scenarios. And so the immediate thing is after a few hours of trying to vainly free the ship from the rocks, they realize we're stuck here and they start abandoning ship. Now, Pelsart and Jacobs are in charge of the rescue operation. They load up the ship's small, it's not really a lifeboat, it's referred to as a yacht. Or a skiff, as it's kind of a small... There's no lifeboats on board.
It's an interfleet vessel.
It's the one where Jacobs had his little love cruise with his girlfriend off the coast of Africa. So there are no lifeboats. It's basically just this one boat that it can have a maximum of about 30 to 40 people on board.
We should say before they start abandoning ship, Jacobs makes his last biggest call as the captain of the Batavia, which is to cut down the mainmast, which was a tactic of such... occasion that it was traditional desperation that it was traditional for the captain himself to put the first blow of the axe in because it was really an all or nothing move. So they topple the mainmast. They think that with the weight of that off, with the pile driver removed, they might be able to refloat and maybe make it to Australia. Unfortunately, the mast crashes directly on the ship, and with that they realize that all hope is finally gone. That's when they start abandoning ship, getting just everything they can and seeing if they find any land.
So basically, Jacobs and Pelsart and a few sailors, they're in the skiff. They find a small patch of sand, which is a little bit past the wreck site. They start ferrying survivors and supplies from the ship over, bit by bit. But it's raining, there's waves crashing everywhere, and they're struggling. The boat can only carry so many people, and there's 341 passengers and crew on board, and about 40 of them drown during this rescue operation in the aftermath.
Immediately in the crash, you also see the bubbling of the mutiny just erupts into outright anarchy. As Pelsart and Jacobs are trying to abandon ship, working together for once, people start looting, people start fighting, people go straight for the booze. There was this one quote from this one survivor who starts hacking into one of their treasure chests and throwing this gold medallion out saying, "There lies the rubbish, even if it is worth so many thousands." There's another guy who runs into the captain's quarters with his knife, chases out the guard, says, "Out, cats and dogs. You have been masters here long enough. Now I will be master for a while." It's basically the acts of people who know they're going to die imminently, and they just almost resign themselves to it. Like, there's a lot of people who end up just staying on this boat as it wrecks, just drinking and fighting. And
well, most of them can't swim, and there's only one rescue boat, which can carry only so many people. So the people that have been taken by Pelsart and Jacobs in the boat, they're left on this this tiny island that we mentioned before, which they sort of use as a dropping off point. So everything they can salvage from the ship, they're dropping off there. So they're in the middle, as Carl mentioned before, it's a coral inlet. So the ship, the Batavia, has wrecked itself on a reef. Sort of a few hundred meters down from the reef is this tiny speck of sand and earth where they're putting people. And a few hundred meters beyond that, we have a slightly larger island, and so Jacob cites that, and he says, "Well, look, there's nowhere that we can put all these people. This tiny speck that we're using, it's not going to work. We'll start ferrying people across to there." And so this island later becomes known as Batavia's Graveyard.
Batavia's Graveyard is about 450 meters long, about 270 meters wide. It's basically a triangle, and to give a bit more of a description, these islands are only a couple of meters above sea level. They have absolutely no elevation, and there's also no protection from the elements. They're formed of this basically solid limestone coral scrub with a nice guano icing topping. They've got a bit of vegetation, these spiky beaten down shrubs, which are pretty much beaten straight to the earth by the huge gales of wind. There's almost nothing in the way of pools for water, and on Batavia's graveyard, the best you can do is pretty much just scrabble for birds that land, and if you're lucky, a couple of rats in terms of food.
Sort of the worst shipwreck ever. It's not like a Robinson Crusoe fun island where it's like massive palm trees and animals and, and things like that.
There's not even trees. There's nothing to protect you from the wind.
Okay, so they've dumped people from a sinking ship onto first onto a tiny island and then onto a slightly larger island, which just really doesn't have anything on it. It's at this stage, so this has been going on throughout the day following the wreck. So it wrecked in the middle of the night. Throughout the night and throughout the morning, Pelsart and Jacobs keep ferrying people back and forth. But as we mentioned before, order's broken down on the ship. There's a lot of looting. Every time they do a return voyage, it becomes more and more unsafe. And also the people that they're ferrying to the larger island, Batavia's graveyard, are also starting to become more chaotic on there. It gets to the stage where Pelsart and Jacobs sail over there to drop off some drinking water. And Jacob's noticing that there's people fighting on the beach. It's getting really rowdy. People are shouting. He recommends that Pelsart doesn't go ashore. He says, look, I think these people, they're ready to attack the people that they think are responsible for the ship sinking, which is you and me. So we shouldn't go on there.
Also the fact that they were in one of the only rowable boats left. So Jacobs was really worried that if you get that boat close enough to these desperate people, they're going to do to him what he wanted to do to Pelsart in the first place. They're going to take it over. Even if they didn't know how to sail it, just in their sheer desperation, they were going to take it over.
Sort of the Costa Concordia excuse, that Italian cruise ship that wrecked last year, where the captain he claimed that he fell overboard and just fell into a lifeboat, and he slipped, and it was all a big accident. So Pelsart's saying, I really wanted to give these people water. I tried. I was jumping up. People were holding me back. So at this stage, there's 70 people on the ship, including Cornelius, who are having kind of an end-of-the-world party. Pelsart and Jacobs, they're in the only boat with 48 sailors, so they sort of overpack it. They've got 48 sailors and passengers, and they sort of can't go back to the boat, and they can't go to the island where they put the rest of the survivors.
So the rest of survivors being about 180 people.
So it's kind of like they're strung out in three places, and it's at this stage that Jacobs has an idea.
So this is when they start to strike out a bit further and see if they can find water on the Australian coast.
Which may or may not be an excuse. Basically, Jacobs and Pelsart, later they say, look, we needed water, and also someone's got to go to Indonesia and alert the authorities and get a rescue ship to come pick us up. So who better than us who have the only boat? So they actually sail away, and as they sail away, it's sort of in full sight of all the survivors on the wreck and all the survivors who are on Batavia's graveyard. And can you tell us, what's Cornelius doing at this stage? Because he's on the ship with the 70 other people, and the ship's kind of being broken apart by the waves. What's his state of mind at the time?
Cornelius, by the time Pelsart heads off for Australia and then to Indonesia to find rescue, Cornelius has actually become isolated on the ship. He is now the only person in the front part of the boat, and he's managed to just cling to what's called the bowsprit, which is the sort of the pole on the front end of the ship. If you've ever built a ship in the bottle, you might know that.
But I certainly have not.
It's kind of like the big pole on the front. He's just clinging to that. It's the highest ground available. Everyone else who's on the ship is kind of in this other part. Cornelius can't swim. And for the last 2 days that he's on the ship, he's probably without food and water as well. About that time, about 2 days, I think, after Pelsart strikes off for Indonesia.
Pelsart and Jacobs, they essentially run away. The ship is still there, even though it's falling apart. There's still supplies on there. There's still people. I mean, they're the two highest officials just about on the ship. The head of the driver of the ship, as we mentioned, Jacobs, and Pelsart, who's meant to be in command of what once was a fleet and then was a ship and now is sort of just a wreck. So they've gone off. And yet Cornelius is sort of being left to his own devices.
Cornelius, now with the captain away and Pelsart away, Cornelius is the highest ranking person among the survivors, being the undermerchant. So he manages somehow to float on the driftwood when the bowsprit finally falls off. He floats on that and he washes up on Batavia's graveyard. He's the last person to make it off the wreck alive. When he arrives on Batavia's graveyard, the survivors all sort of are very happy that he's there because he's an authority figure, and authority figures are sorely lacking at this point.
So at the moment on Batavia's graveyard, this desert island, there's 180 survivors from the ship. And in the Dutch East India Company, everything was run by committees. So the survivors, they've basically washed up on this desert island. They have some supplies of provisions, but probably not enough. And the first thing they do is they elect a committee to run the island. It's led by the surgeon on the ship, and it's assisted by a guy who's the provost, essentially the sheriff. His job on the ship was to keep law and order. They're delighted to see Cornelius. He's an authority figure, and they elect him to the island's council.
And as the predicant says later, at the beginning he behaved himself very well. What he does is, probably with a new lease on life, having pretty much escaped what he would have seen as imminent death, he's thrown into action. He immediately dresses himself up in Pelsart's finest clothes, which did make the trip to Batavia's graveyard, and he starts organizing hunting parties to see if they can snag a few birds.
So, you're saying he, like, single white female Pelsart, he just started wearing everything and living in his tent?
I don't think they quite had his massive sort of Pelsart mansion built yet, but he definitely had access to his clothes. So he was dressed in that. He starts supervising the building of these tents, and he starts sort of getting a couple of carpenters to see if they can build some rafts from the driftwood that's sent out. So at the beginning, there's enough sort of adrenaline, sort of immediate action necessary that he's making himself quite useful. But that all starts to change because of two things. The first one is that he takes stock of the island. He sees the people who are on there. And these include about 20 women, about 25 kids, a lot of whom would have been 14 to 15-year-old cabin boys.
Also, there are babies born on board as well.
So yeah, they're very, yeah, very young. Other than that, there's also about 100 soldiers and sailors. So there's a lot of mouths to feed. And one of those mouths actually starts flapping its gums. Rykert Wouters, this one sort of mutineer they drafted, starts getting a bit rowdy. Fueled with this anger at Jacobs for just abandoning them, he starts talking about the mutiny they planned. And initially, because it's only been a couple of days since they crashed, people are just either ignoring it, disbelieving it, or just not really registering it. But he keeps on talking about it. He's just really disgruntled.
And what's Cornelius' policy towards loose cannons?
Cornelius is not a fan of loose cannons. Yeah,
snitches get stitches.
That's right. Cornelius doesn't know whether this guy knew that he himself was part of the mutiny, because he kept that pretty well under wraps. You know, he only personally approached people he was very sure of. But at the same time, he thought, we're going to have to think up some kind of long-term plan.
Well, his reaction is to restart the mutiny. So he's like, well, we're about to be outed as having plotted to take command of the ship, which, even though we didn't have a chance because the ship is now underwater, that's still a capital offence. So if a rescue boat ever comes, if Pelsart and Jans ever come back, if they hear about this, I'm a dead man. So he starts reactivating the original group that had
Operation
recruited
Mutiny.
Operation Mutiny is
and
back
there's,
on.
There's also the plan that not only do they have to do it because the word's getting out, but a lot of them think this doesn't change anything. They think, you know, our one ship's, you know, at the bottom of the sea, but when the rescue ship comes, if they manage to get a rescue ship out here, we'll just steal that and we'll go off. I mean, we won't have all of the money that the Batavia had, but we'll still have our shot at freedom.
But they also could have had some of the money as well. So they've managed to save. There's a little bit of, so it's sort of all Pelsart's finery and some jewels that they've saved. But the cash that was on the ship, the 25 million, that's still sort of a reef away. That's kind of underwater, but it's still accessible if you dive for it. All they need is a ship. All they need is a way out. And possibly they can take some of the money with them.
And what they also need, what they absolutely need, is absolute control of the people on the island, so that when the boats come, they have free access to just go commandeer them. And they probably only really want to take people who are part of their gang. So this is when Geronimus's sort of civil planning suit gets turned a bit more sinister. He starts, you know, still in the spirit of organizing, he does things like getting all the weapons gathered together and put in one tent, which only he has control over. He also starts recruiting in full force again. He has his pick of the litter this time, whereas before he was limited in the amount of people he could approach because people of his rank only sort of mingled with a certain amount of other people. Now he's sort of up with all of these soldiers and sailors that were on the ship, but inaccessible. So he recruits a few German mercenaries, but his best recruit is this guy called David Zwank, who was a clerk on the ship, but who was also pretty built and really good with a sword. And this guy was, by all accounts, just as much of a psychopath as he was.
It's basically a mini-me for Cornelius, as we'll find out. So he's got the German mercenaries, this David Zwank to control them. He's the most senior-ranking company official on the island. He's got the only access to any of the weapons that they've got stored in this tent that's near his. And he sort of starts, again, extending the tentacles of this conspiracy. It's said that he acted very subtly and gradually so that in the first 20 days, none of this could be perceived. It's all undercurrents.
So his next step, after gathering all the weapons, recruiting afresh, is to get rid of some of the dead weight that's hanging around this this island.
Yeah, so the mutineers are outnumbered 6-1. So there's, for every one person who's a mutineer and who's in on the plot, there's 6 other people who know nothing about it. So his solution to that is he starts sending people off. By this stage, they've built a few rough rafts. There are a lot of carpenters on the ship, and they've been saving all the driftwood that's come to them, and they've built a couple of crude rafts. So Cornelius starts getting all the people who aren't mutineers and sending them out on these rafts to explore the rest of the island chain. So they can see sort of other islands off in the distance, and to know what's there, he says that we've got to go look for fresh water. First of all, he sends some of the mutineers off as scouts. They report, yep, there's a few other islands which are, some are smaller than the one we're on, some are bigger, but we don't think there's fresh water there. Cornelius's plan is that he'll send out the people who aren't mutineers, and they'll die of thirst on these islands which don't have fresh water. And the drinking water that they have, that'll be held on Batavia's graveyard, and the mutineers will be the only ones with access to it.
So immediately he's gotten rid of 40 people off to the island directly across from them, and he's sent 15 across to Traitor's Island, which was the tiny dot that they first landed on, that Pelsart and Jacobs took off from.
And because it's a tiny dot, obviously there's no water there, so instead he tells them, oh, can you build some more rafts? There's some driftwood there. So he sends them off on a raft-building mission. He also sends the guy who mentioned before, the provost, who is the official sheriff on the ship, who is meant to keep law and order, and as I think it's fair to say, done a pretty bad job of that. So this is like the second mutiny, the second conspiracy that he's failed to spot. And so his name is Peter Jarnes, and he's sent out there with 15 people, and Cornelius is right, yep, your assignment is build me some rafts.
Yeah, go be the sheriff of raft building. So he also gets some of these soldiers that he didn't peg as mutineers, didn't really want to recruit. He gets 20 soldiers, and he sends them to the very furthest island, which is quite a big one. They call it High Island because it seems to be a bit more elevated than the others.
And they can vaguely see it in the distance. But basically, he sends 20 of them off, 20 of the people that he thinks are the most dangerous opponents, potential opponents. He sends them off in the worst boat with no weapons and just says, hey, if you find some water over there, light a signal fire and we'll come get you. And then he takes the boat back. So he's just marooned them there and he's hoping that they'll die of thirst.
And one of those soldiers was this guy called Weber Hayes, who was just a regular soldier. He didn't have rank or anything. But he was recognized by Pelsart during the crash as being immediately helpful and sort of good head in a crisis. He was helping people out. He was keeping very even-tempered when other people were panicking. And he sort of rose to a natural leadership position among some of the soldiers. So he's among the 20 people to get sent out right over to High Island.
So the balance of power has completely changed. All the people that Geronimus thinks are potential dangerous opponents, he's sent far, far away, and all the people that he doesn't want to have around, he thinks are sort of the cabin boys and some of the women, he's sent out to build rafts or he's sent to the island directly across from them. He's in command of the island, but he's still ruling through this council. So there's still other dissenting voices. You've still got the ship's doctor, the surgeon, who's on the council, and there's a few other people, like the other priest that was on the ship. So he's kind of sharing power with them, and he's not too happy about that.
So at this stage, there's about 100 or so people on Batavia's graveyard, and probably around 30 were mutineers at this stage. So now Euronymous is really just waiting for an excuse to further consolidate his power, and he gets that on the 4th of July, when this soldier, Abraham Hendricks, taps this keg of wine and shares it with a fellow soldier or sailor. And Geronimus hears about this, and he sentences them both to death for stealing. Now, the council, they say, yeah, we agree, the first guy, the guy that actually stole it, he's dead, he should die. But the guy that he just shared it with, that guy, like, he's not that bad. He didn't really commit any crime himself, he just sort of partook in the spoils. So they disagree with him about that, and Geronimus really spits the dummy. He dismisses the council, and he says, you guys cannot handle this island life. I'm going to elect my own council.
And he just stacks it with his allies. So we have that guy, David Zavank, who's second in command, who's put on the council as well as a bunch of other mutineers, and so he now has full authority on the island. Still, people, they're not quite sure. It just looks like a spat between Geronimus and some of the other people in a leadership position. It doesn't seem particularly serious.
So the inauguration of the council, is basically Geronimus tells Zvank and Stonecutter.
Stonecutter is the he's a corporal. He's a member of the mercenary force on board, and he's called Stonecutter because he's physically huge.
So he tells those two to take four men out on a raft and drown three. He gets four men out on the raft and tells them, drown three, make the other one watch,
back. Why is he... So what? That's just like his first acting off. It's like, all right, drown
some
people.
Yeah, it's like first 100 days, you know, you got to make an impact. You got to get some good
the
policy.
People have got to remember you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's his big... That's like his version of Obamacare, is take these four guys out on a raft and drown three of them and make the other one watch. This is going to be his new tactic of choice for a while. He's still moving underground in the sense of he's not committing murder openly, but is still following this policy of, by the time the rescue ship comes here, I want it to be basically just me and my mutineers.
So everyone who's not a mutineer, they're either going to die of thirst on the other islands where he sent them, or he's going to kill them.
He's going to try and knock them off, pretty much slasher movie style. Find people who sort of get alone or get isolated, who don't really join the other groups on the island. Wait till everyone's back is turned, and then take these guys out and drown them and hide the bodies. So even though it's a tiny island and there's nowhere to hide, every night and every morning now, people are starting to wake up and there's less and less people, and their bodies aren't even there. They've just disappeared.
So it's a murder mystery on a desert island kind of thing, like a dinner party where you can never leave.
It's like a dinner party, except the dinner is raw birds. Next episode on Last Stop to Nowhere, Geronimus Cornelizun continues his murderous regime on the island, coercing mutineers and survivors alike into killing one another. But on the other side, the soldiers, led by Weber Hayes, mount a fierce resistance while they hold out hope that Pell Sartre is returning with a rescuing party from Batavia.
Last Stop to Nowhere is a Hook Turn production recorded at Float in Melbourne, just north of the river. You can find more great podcasts or get in touch with this show by visiting hookturn.com.au.